So the our men need to step up to the mark, commit earlier, and just get going. And, you know, they are not Rod Stewarts or Picassos that can produce babies into their 80s that are a strong, fit and healthy.
Welcome to the Social Fabric Podcast. I'm your host, Andreas Flenduri, and this week my guest is Elina Turberti. Elina is an expert in fertility and provides coaching, advice and support to her clients that are trying to conceive naturally or using medical fertility treatments such as IVF. There are over 90 episodes in the archive, and you can access them through iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Please subscribe, share, and review. It's the only way independent podcasts like this have a chance to survive. The songs in this podcast have been shortened for rights reason. You can find a full playlist on Spotify under Social Fabric. The title tune is Alice by Lucky Bones. If you'd like to get in touch with the program, please email me at info@socialfabric.ie.
Can I call you up, oh Alice, on a Friday night? We could reminisce on old days and we could talk a while.
So I'm really very, very lucky. And yeah, it's really lovely because I love your podcasts, they're fantastic. I loved the interview with Caroline West. I always think podcasts are like eavesdropping in a way. It's a marvelous way to find out what people are thinking, yeah, what really matters, what's changed their lives. And something I find with my clients is I never regard it as work because I'm having these fascinating conversations where people are telling me literally how they got to where they are,
yeah,
what happened along the way. Yeah. And we're kind of just, you know, it's a sense of being able to set it out and, you know, examine, well, you know, things aren't going so terribly well, what could be different, what would be nice, what would be useful, without discarding stuff or whatever. So it's conversations, I think, are vastly underrated.
Absolutely. And that's what I'm trying to promote.
Yes, and you're very much about connecting. Excuse me, I grew up in a lovely little place called Killiney, a village by the sea, 60s and 70s, and I've never recovered from living there. We were right over the sea, and the, you know, the bay, and you wake up in the sea. It was just incredibly, stunningly beautiful. And now I'm living in Meath by mistake.
Well, let me start from there then. So just so people know, I'm talking to Elina Turberti, fertility expert, coaching, advice and support. But that's where we start. We're going to start from Killiney. That's where you grew up. Tell me a bit about Elina growing up in Killiney and a little bit about your background, please.
It was actually marvelous because at the age of 4, I managed to drop out of school and become a beach bum. I'd been with the local nuns in Loretta and Dorky, and they were all about hellfire and brimstone. And apparently I was horrified because my family had become galloping atheists. So I got to drop out of school, and I spent 2.5 years as a beach bum on Killiney Beach in the 60s, collecting bottles, making money, and just having the best time a human being could have. It was glorious until my grandmother discovered that I was illiterate at the age of 6, and she took over and taught me Latin and French, and she had me reading David Copperfield in about, I think it was 8 weeks, and she taught me how to sew on a button and how to make a roux, and honestly it was all I ever needed to learn. But obviously I went back to school, to the local Protestant primary school, which was you know, in the family, actually coming from a sort of a Catholic family background, that was kind of not spoken about. And then I loved the school. It was chosen for me because it had a sea view. And I then was unceremoniously landed over the hill as a social experiment. And I was interested because you were speaking with a wonderful Caroline West, and she and I went to the same school. I was one of the very first pupils in Sallynoggin Comprehensive School, and I actually firmly believed I was going to be knifed at any time. It was scary. And it was the first time I'd ever heard the F word used. I was very unfamiliar with that kind of thing. And in actual fact, I made one of my lifelong friends there. We're friends to this day. And anyway, I ended up then going immediately off the end of first year. I went to boarding school, Roman Catholic boarding school in Limerick, which was lovely. I mean, it was the very best of Roman Catholic. It was a French order, great food, lovely manners, you know, obviously religion all day long. I had to learn a lot of stuff. And you talk about suffering from imposter syndrome. I had to learn prayers and, you know, rituals and all kinds of things. So that was interesting, to say the very least.
But go back one second. You said something there at the age of four and a half, your parents became atheists.
No, they already were.
They sent me to the Okay.
They'd given up on Roman Catholicism at that stage. And, you know, they were quite happy to kind of go along. So I grew up, and I was considered myself a second generation atheist. And I kind of, I suppose my basic tenet would be, it's kind of like by each other we live. So that would be a very firm, I suppose, just belief in helping each other and, you know, doing the best we possibly can in situations. So, for instance, now at the moment, I mean, I'm kind of slightly in the horrors that at this advanced age of my life, I've signed up with the HSE in case they need an extra hand. I've re-registered myself as a nurse. So I'd been off the register for donkey's years. And the sense of duty, I suppose, was very, you know, very strongly instilled in me. So being without religion does not mean you're without morals, principles, or anything like that, as some people seem to believe.
So even all the years in a nice Catholic school in Limerick didn't change your mind. You just went along with the prayers and.
I did what I had to do. I always felt I'd be found out at some stage. And no, they were the very best. I was very lucky. I got the best of the, you know, the Roman Catholic system. And I got the very best of the Church of Ireland. But I do feel I would lean much more towards Church of Ireland, Anglican. Their baking is a lot better. They look after the living. They don't have to wait till the next one.
I like that. So tell me something. Zorba the Greek, Sirtaki. What a great tune. That's your first choice. Tell me about it.
Yes. I actually learned to dance that the other day. You know, between clients on Showtime, because I'm doing a lot of online work now, I have been, you know, deciding that I must, obviously I'm mad into learning. And I thought, finally, I'm not going to be able to go to Greece for a while. And the Sirtaki was one of the soundtracks of my childhood, you know, in this incredible place looking out to the sea. The music of Zorba the Greek and Never on Sunday, Melina Mercouri, all of that kind of stuff. So I haven't burdened you with opera, which was another soundtrack. I am a bit of a heathen. I like opera, but probably only highlights, so I'm not a proper highbrow one. So I thought that Zorba the Greek, it's used in a lot of flash mobs. It connects people. It has an elemental beauty and rhythm that just sends me.
Let's stay for a second with the chronology before we get to your profession, because you went on then to, so you've done all your Catholic and upbringing and non-upbringing and all of that. You went on to finish your study and you got into midwifery. Is that the first thing you did or university?
I did nursing training, the apprenticeship system in a very small hospital in Dublin. And that was, again, another quaint outfit. Funny, old-fashioned, warm. A lot of cardiac work was being done. So very innovative and a great bunch of people with slightly Protestant tradition going on. And then after that, I went and did midwifery in Plymouth because I certainly didn't want to do it in Ireland where there were no epidurals and people were still being advised to offer up their pain for the holy souls and single mothers had a special unit because they were horribly unclean. So I went off to Plymouth beginning of the 80s when I had forgotten to remember that the Troubles were in full swing, and Plymouth was a military town, a naval town, an Air Force town, a Territorial Army town, a Submariners town, and a lot of the men there, the husbands, had been on tours in Northern Ireland. So an Irish nurse was as welcome as you can fill in the rest yourself.
And what was it like? I mean, you arrived there, you were quite young, straight up.
Yes, I arrived there, and I mean, most of my granduncles, about eight granduncles of mine, had been through either one or two world wars, mostly as doctors. And I really felt that I was arriving over and I would be very welcome. And I got a fairly rude awakening. However, I did fit in, and the training was superlative. The care, the clinical expertise, the warmth, the home deliveries, the domino system, epidurals were available, and so was hypnosis. So my mother had used hypnosis to have her babies, golly, it's nearly 70 years ago now, her first, second child in Africa. So hypnosis was very familiar to me as a way of reducing pain and fear and all of that. So I must say my Plymouth experience was wonderful. Again, it was beside the sea, which I absolutely love. And, you know, I met so many interesting people from all over England because, of course, they'd come because, you know, family members being in the services. And it was a fabulous experience. And I got to do an incredible amount of horse riding up on the moors on Dartmoor. And I loved horse riding. So, you know, it really was just a very special time in my life.
Man. So in terms of the decision to go into midwifery, I mean, obviously you say quite a few of your family were in the medical world. But why midwifery? Why midwifery, I should say?
Well, my mother was a pharmacist. My father was a vet. And, you know, I was used to being around new life and death as well. And certainly in my general training, I had done a lot with care of the dying, which I was really comfortable with. And midwifery is the opposite pole. And, you know, back in the day, midwifery really rounded out your nursing career. And it was something I kind of felt that I wanted to get in a journalistic way to find out what was it all about? What was it like? It was always a kind of a scary taboo, the sense of, you know, incredible pain, difficulty, you know, destruction and death. And I wanted to find out what it was like. And I have an investigative streak in me. So I really got to find out so many different aspects, you know, the clinical aspect, the gentleness, I call the midwife, of home birth, domino delivery, care of a healthy woman, a healthy couple during a special time. And how, I suppose, it has changed to be pathologized or McDonaldized, being brought into hospital, and the expectation of so many sections, you know, C-sections and all of that. So I got a wonderful overview, and I got a lot about preconceptual care, getting ready for a healthy pregnancy, that I guess fueled the next stages of my career and sparked an interest in the health of the body and the health of the mind, and how they interact.
Yeah, wonderful. Okay, so you have this great song after Sound of Silence, but the Disturbed version, which is brilliant. It's a brilliant version. Why that song?
That song was, I never liked the original incarnation of it. It was high and tinny and horrendous. I never liked it. Until a couple of years ago, I heard, and it was actually the Disturbed version that was on a chat show. And they had drums, and that's even more powerful. It's not the official version, but the strength of David's voice, his power, his passion, the beauty of the male voice unleashed, and the fact that it is so different to his normal work, which really wouldn't appeal to me because I always feel it's kind of damaging. But it is, you know, the sense of how we talk and rarely connect. And, you know, the number of conversations I've had sitting on a bed at 4 in the morning, somebody who might perhaps be dying or very, very ill, the absolute, you know, the raw reality. The sense, as we were saying earlier, about connecting with people, how social media may have even falsified that to a certain extent. But you know how you could have a conversation, you know, stranded at an airport and spend 3 hours talking to a complete stranger and have the most profound conversations. I love that randomness of connection. And I think The Sound of Silence really has a lot to tell us.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again. Because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.
So your current profession, you followed, anyway, years of professional midwifery and many studies. I went through your website and I stopped halfway through on all the different degrees you have and certification. But no, it's fantastic. And as we just spoke about before I turned on the microphone, I'd be very similar. I don't have that many, but I just love learning and doesn't matter what it is. But obviously you followed your career. But tell me about first of all, tell us what you do now. I know, tell us exactly what your practice is.
So I'm a fertility coach and therapist, and I do hate the word coach, but it's a way of saying that I am here to help, support and advise people who are trying to conceive, have had difficulty conceiving, helping them navigate infertility to pregnancy and beyond, preparing them for IVF if necessary, boosting natural fertility. So it is about, I suppose, bringing together all my expertise in getting people across the line to having their own baby, dealing with the emotional roller coaster that it is, and dealing with the trauma that infertility actually is. So as well as having been a midwife and having been a gynae nurse, knowing about the actual nuts and bolts, the clinical aspect, I am also a psychotherapist, and it is not saying that people need psychotherapy, that they're somehow damaged or mad or bad or sad. This is about keeping the plot, because mind and body, as you know, interact, and it is about keeping them in the, what you might call, a fertility mindset, and dealing with all the downs that happen on the way. And I am seeing perfectly healthy, happy people who do exhibit or do, you know, have some level of distress and anxiety attached to waiting to conceive as each month goes by. The uncertainty is crippling, and I use some trauma therapy. I am trained in EMDR, and I use hypnotherapy because it's a wonderful way of focusing the mind so that I can work in brief therapy. I might see somebody for only maybe 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe 8 sessions at the most. So it's not ongoing. People don't become reliant or dependent. They get medically accurate information. They get all the hacks and hints and tips. And they get to, I suppose, you know, factually based information, because I'm a really interesting person. I like reading academic studies for fun. I really love finding out what actually is happening, what's working, why is it working, and, you know, what's shifting and changing in the fertility field. So I bring all of that to bear as well, kind of dietary advice, lifestyle advice, all of the stuff that actually works to improve the mind and the body for conceiving a healthy pregnancy. I also help people who've had miscarriage, stillbirth, fatal fetal abnormalities, stillbirth, neonatal death. So, you know, the other end of the scale that we don't talk about so much. I mean, IVF is wonderful, but it is, shall we say, maybe only 1 in 4 are successful. There's a high level of miscarriage. There's a high level of preterm birth. So that side of things that needs to be addressed as well. It's a kind of a continuity and a matrix. And no day is the same for me. No one, you know, clients are so different. Their narratives, their journeys are really, really different. So I get enormous satisfaction out of what I do. And it honestly does not feel remotely like work.
Sounds fantastic. But before, I want to get into the nuts and bolts in a second. But first, I want to, why did you decide this? When did you decide to set this practice, and why did you decide?
I didn't remotely.
Okay.
I never expected to be doing this in a million years. I was living in Donnybrook. I had a perfectly respectable job as the manager of a medical surgical supply shop. I was helping people who'd had mastectomy. I was fitting external prosthetics and bras and advising and supporting people, as well as being involved in sales, which I was ridiculously good at. And I had a car, and you know, life was really, really good. And at the same time, a lot of my friends were coming to the end of our 20s. They were burning out in the medical profession, in the nursing, and having difficulty conceiving. And I just seemed to be the go-to person. People asked me advice, what they should be doing. And, you know, stuff that was totally natural to me. You know, have you done this? What about this? You know, looking at their situation. And people started just, you know, getting pregnant. So I, at the same time, decided, I'm always learning, that I had been doing, as a clinical research associate, I'd been doing a lot of driving. I have very strong hands. And I had learned how to do massage because, you know, when you're driving, this was, I was back in Bath for a year or so. And I learned to, you know, just literally do massage. And then my local beauty salon in Donnybrook, they had a spare floor and they offered it to me. So I was doing a few evenings a week. And I used to have to warn people to make sure their contraception was up to date, because people just, they had a habit of falling pregnant. And it took, I'd say it took about a year or so, at least, before I realized, do you know what? People actually need help on this score. And that's when I began to get more and more kind of funneled into it, if you like. And just finding I really loved it. And of course, you know, obviously it's wonderful when a couple conceives against all the odds. And, you know, not a week goes by that I don't get five or six, you know, calls or texts or DMs and PMs nowadays saying, guess what? And that is an absolute incredible joy. And then, you know, seeing the little baby, seeing the pictures and that is lovely. And I also, of course, do reflexology, which is a very interesting, again, slightly massage type therapy, which is, you know, using the feet. And I like the neuroscience end of that. So there is the sort of emotional care and the fertility mindset, and then a physicality as well.
Lovely. Okay. Dire Straits, Brothers in Arms. Why did you pick that song?
Driving around the UK, I was based in Bath, which is unbelievably beautiful, stunning location. And I had a company car for the very first time, and I used to be heading up to Buckinghamshire, Scotland, Wales, you name it. We traveled a long, long distance to set up clinical trials. And I had the open road, you know, the motorway system. And I used to have, you know, REM, ZZ Top, and Dire Straits blasting at full tilt. And I always felt that, you know, the, again, connections with people, that we are brothers in arms. We, you know, I've always wanted to go back to Killiney. I have a very strong connection there, and the sense of, you know, the place that's home to me. And I've lived in a lot of different places, but yet I still want to return. And I think human beings have that connection with a birthplace, or, you know, a place they associate with their childhood, and the sense that you can form connections. And I think that's what people are doing right now, forming very strong bonds in adversity, difficult situations. So, for instance, you know, when I was a midwife working with in special care baby units, where, you know, things were very fraught, we worked double shifts, you know, there was disease and death, and you formed very, 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 very close bonds with the people with whom you worked. And that was always very precious to me in whatever area I was in. So, Brothers in Arms. These mist-covered mountains are home now for me, but my home is the lowlands, and always will be.
someday you'll return.
The couple of interviews I listened to and I read some stuff about you, what I liked about it is you mentioned it's everything you do is research based. It's not, as you, I think as you put it, airy fairy stuff. It's not just come to me, I'll put my hand on your forehead and you'll be fine. So, but at the same time, you do talk about the reflexology. So in terms of what is out there at the moment, the methods that are available and versus what you provide. So let's start with the IVF, for example. I was reading there that was Aldous Huxley, Brave New World. It was the very first time that the IVF was mentioned. He kind of predicted something was going to happen. And then after that, IVF became a thing, and it's been whatever since the 40s. And you mentioned earlier on the success rate is not particularly great. I read some statistics, what have you. And also, there's a serious cost associated with it. And I know you mentioned it again before, but just tell me a bit about the IVF and that world before people come to you, having tried different things that are available.
So actually I'm listening to Brave New World at this very moment on Audible.
There you go.
Aldous Huxley does base his work on work that actually was being done even at that stage. We think IVF is, you know, relatively recent, but it does have roots way back in, that century before he was writing. So it's very stark, and I'm absolutely riveted to it at the moment. IVF is wonderful, but the success rate really hasn't changed a huge lot since Louise Brown was born. It is useful. It was particularly designed for blocked tubes. It's used just as a silver bullet now. There is an expectation socially, you know, if we're not conceiving, we shall go straight to IVF and that will work. And people are very devastated and disappointed. The cost is massive. And as you know, I very recently completed a master's in ethics, and my thesis was IVF, our clinics, and, you know, how ethical is our fertility care. And I found, surprisingly enough, that it's not incredibly ethical, because it's a business model. It is not particularly medical. And, the client is very much a customer as opposed to a patient in traditional medicine. And, you know, the costs are outrageous. And, you know, Professor Sir Robert Winston in Genesis in London was involved in the very early stages of IVF. And he's been around a long time. And he says the cost should not be more than about 500 sterling. And I concur with him. There are huge costs associated. There are add-ons which have no basis of efficacy. There's somebody doing a PhD in that in Leicester at the moment. We don't in Ireland have a regulatory body after all of these years. In England, there is a regulatory overseer, which is very, very important. We don't have, figures that are properly centrally maintained independently. And, you know, it is, I suppose, we really need to rethink it. We still have legislation in Ireland that is due to come in. It hasn't come in. It's probably not going to come in for ages yet. Money set aside for people to have it on our public health system, because at the moment it is privately run. Some of our clinics have been sold to corporations from abroad, so they are purely profit-based. And the whole thing really needs a rejig. And I am, and as you said there, that I use reflexology, and I'd just like to point out that the reflexology I am particularly interested in is from Dr. Manzanares, who's a Spanish doctor on the front lines at the moment. And he's done a lot of study on how using reflexology affects the mind and how it affects physically. So he's done proper research. I don't really subscribe to the notions of the Chinese medicine angle at all. And the Chinese are the fastest adapters to IVF since the last 10 or 15 years. So the sense that IVF is very useful, but people dive into it far too quickly without preparation. It's a bit like going for a marathon. without having trained up gradually. So people come to me, they will maybe have had one or two failed attempts. That is probably about 12,000 euro gone. They're very dispirited, very depressed, very hopeless. And where I come into the equation is rebooting and rebalancing, so that the sense of helping them to physically make changes that are very useful for fertility. Everything from the usual diet, lifestyle type of things, to sexual activity, to the mindset, lifting anxiety and depression, all of that kind of thing.
Just one thing about the IVF, you mentioned there, if it was to go on the HSE as a public, would that not cause more, like, people going to IVF a lot quicker than they would if they couldn't afford it? No?
I would imagine that what you would need is a triage. So I would envisage it in an ideal world, mm-hmm. that someone would be properly a couple, and it is a couple's issue.
Sure. Sure.
That both would have adequate investigations, and they would be guided in living a lifestyle that would support fertility, and that it would only be as absolutely required where there is a very good chance of it's actually helping to conceive a child, that it would be used, and that costs would dramatically plummet if the government were purveying it, that it should and could create a very good overseeing of it.
This song you have, Jennifer Saunders, singing Bonnie Tyler, holding out for a hero from, is it Shrek? Shrek, you said? Yeah, that's a fantastic version. Why that version?
It's a lovely version, and it's so tongue-in-cheek. She's absolutely, I love comedy. I love stand-up. I love any kind of comedy. It's helped me through some very tragic times. I believe in laughter and fun, and in my sessions, there's always some laughter and fun. Even if it is the blackest humor, there is humor. And this song brings me right back to being with my girls and leaping, as we always would have done, around the kitchen to this, and, you know, playing it on loop and loving it. And the sheer exuberance of music and a good song, a rousing song. And Shrek was a great movie too, but this soundtrack is just superb.
C minor, put it in C minor.
Where have all the good men gone, and where are all the gods? Where's the streetwise Hercules to fight the rising odds? Isn't there a white knight upon a fiery steed? Late at night, I toss and I turn.
You mentioned a few things there. I totally agree. Obviously, it's a couple thing, and I'm just picturing that. Thankfully, we two children, and we didn't have to go. We started late enough, but obviously not too late. Both of our children were premature, by the way, which brought its own stress. But we were cared wonderfully by Hollis Street, and so they're both there, annoying teenagers now. That's all. No, but it's all good. But I can just picture paying this 12,000, 18,000, whatever it takes to get an IVF. It just adds to the stress that obviously is what you're trying to fix, because mens sana and corporis sanus, the Latin used to say, you know, keep it all in balance. So your methodology, talk me a little bit through it. Like, if I just spend 12,000, And I'm guessing the man gets more stressed out about the financial than the woman, and then he starts to put the blame on sometimes, or feels it's not his problem. It's more, I don't know. I'm just speculating here, but I can just try to figure out what the couple coming to you, what the story can be, and what do you do about it?
Well, for starters, I never see couples.
Okay.
I see one person at a time, because I like to develop a relationship with one person. So generally speaking, I will see usually a woman. Women bear the brunt of the whole fertility angle. In Ireland, we also have something that is an issue that guys do not commit to a relationship until they really absolutely have to. Women are much more aware. So this business of saying, oh, women are leaving it later, they're, you know, they're so old starting, it's kind of like it's really hard to get a guy to actually say, you know what, let's get this show on the road and, you know, see how it goes. Guys, you know, women are in relationships where they're waiting and hoping to kind of, you know, go to the next level, afraid to push it, to appear needy. And guys forget that they are, their fertility is, it may not be falling off a cliff, as Kirsty also famously said, but their fertility is rolling down that hill from the age of 35. They're building up DNA fragmentation that leads to things like studies show autism, ASDs, even some childhood diseases and heart disease in later life, preterm delivery, high blood pressure during pregnancy, miscarriage. So our men need to step up to the mark, commit earlier, and just get going. And, you know, they are not Rod Stewarts or Picassos that can produce babies into their 80s that are strong, fit, and healthy. So men are under-investigated, under-diagnosed, and under-treated. They are, bless them, the little Cinderellas of fertility treatment. We don't have many andrologists. You don't hear of an andrologist, you hear of gynecologists. Men rarely will have seen a urologist. So their plumbing is not plumbed, so to speak. And, you know, when I see a woman, I will discuss with her the history to date, the narrative, what's been going on, what she's experienced, what it's like. And we will form a very loose, flexible kind of treatment plan. So if it's just pure anxiety, giving, you know, the even teaching some mindfulness, if there has been a trauma like a miscarriage, I will use EMDR, which is a very, very, very rapid little treatment to reprogram the emotions around loss and trauma. It was originally used for people with PTSD, and it's just so elegant, so simple. And we can do it on a distance level. A lot of my work now is distance, online. And, you know, anything, you know, discussing what it is like for the partner, what's going on in his life, and if you'd like to talk with me as well, what their sex life is like. And a lot of people, you know, first, for starters, marital sex is a different animal to going out sex. And things quieten down considerably. And then, of course, baby-making sex is another beast altogether. And it becomes a chore. It becomes a post-it on the fridge. It becomes a reminder on the phone. It, instead of something pleasurable, fun, joyous, you know, swift, funny, angry, you know, the wardrobe of sex becomes very, very constricted. So helping people to regain the love and lust of their earlier years is part of what I do. And, you know, having a sense of internal control, it's like, okay, so maybe we need to be getting some more exercise, eating fresher food, doing a bit of cooking at home, dropping the takeouts. You know, 61% of clinic visits are for people with secondary infertility in Ireland. So that means they've had a child. It may be with IVF or maybe totally naturally. And then the horrible big shock that when they are ready to have a little sibling for this little person, ready to be parents again, it just doesn't happen and it keeps not happening. So I do, you know, the sense of an audit on their lifestyle. What's changed since they had this little one? Apart from the obvious thing of age, what can they be doing more of or less of or doing it better? So I do use some hypnosis and hypnotherapy to focus people's minds if they need to get the motivation for doing some exercise, if they need to reduce anxiety so they can enjoy some sex better, if, you know, those kind of things. So it's very fluid. It's very tailored to what people actually need. You know, even advice on supplements, you know, what are decent quality ones? You know, the sense I've seen over the years, what people can do that really helps. And I share that information. And I give people, I suppose, very much the starting point is improving sleep and sleep patterns, getting hope and joy back in, getting that feeling of connection that they still love their partner and that that's why they're together, and taking the panic away from them. So we do that very, very briefly, very quickly, very conversationally.
Mm. I love what you the way you describe the wardrobe of sex, because it never occurred to me that I'm assuming once a couple goes into a program for IVF or whatever it may be, there's also it's all to do with cycles and so on and so forth. So a certain amount of, you know, certain days of the month are better than others. Is that basically what you're talking about? Is it so all of a sudden that day of the month is better than the other day? So put it on the fridge and do it. And then obviously there's no pleasure there.
The typical thing is somebody saying, you know, we're sitting up in bed 10:30 at night, and, you know, he's listening to BBC News, I'm on Instagram, and it's kind of like, we better do the deed because, you know, this is our fertile window, middle of the month, ovulation, got to do this thing. And then the sense of, okay, yeah, grand. And 7 minutes later, he's back on the BBC website, I'm back on Instagram, and that's it, very soulless. So it is, IVF is not about having sex at all, because it's kind of done for you. It's like a
slight. Yeah.
But the medications can be quite rough on the system and the moods, and it's very, very challenging for a woman. And a guy is in a support role. He's standing by, helpless, feeling very feeble, probably with an eye on how many more of these can we do. How much more can we afford? Can we hit the middle of our 40s without any savings? You know, those kind of things are what the guy normally picks up the slack on. And I think that, you know, as a couple, it's very difficult if you're, like, a woman will have to go and have a lot of scans. They're transvaginal scans, and it's known as a date with Wanda. It's not a comfortable thing. And the guy is just going to work. He won't be discussing with his friends. A woman may have some very close friends or family that she can talk about it with, or she may be in a situation where, you know, it could be, for instance, I see a lot of teachers and the staff room. People are coming in with scan photographs. I'm just pregnant. I'm having my third child. Gender reveals, you know, all of these baby showers. So it's an ongoing grief, loss and challenge that is really difficult to live. And I am giving the coping skills, developing the resilience for people to manage it, that things don't get to them, that they can just live while they're very ready to conceive.
Okay, let me break it with Dancing in the Dark by Bruce Springsteen. Another lovely dance song. I could see you jumping around the kitchen while you're making your brownies.
I do. I'm afraid I have a penchant for things like Gold, they just play hits of the long time ago, and Lyric. I love Bruce Springsteen. He's good-humoured, again, tongue-in-cheek, very lively, and he always gives the impression that he has been kind of, you know, breaking stones on the railroad, when in fact, I don't think he ever actually worked a day in his life apart from singing. He is iconic, magical. He loves the Irish audience, and I used to listen to him. My father-in-law's house was in Donnybrook, and from that garden, we could hear the concerts down in Simmons Court. And, you know, getting to see Brucey, this was the 80s. This was, you know, power. It was very happy time. And I think his music lives on really well.
I get up in the evening, and I ain't got nothing to say. I come home in the morning, I go to bed feeling the same way. I ain't nothing but tired. Man, I'm just tired and bored with myself. Hey there, baby, I could use just a little help. It can't start a fire.
You mentioned a few things while talking about your clients, and also talking about your ex-colleagues, the midwives. So there's a lot of strain on mental health. It's a big issue, right? In the people you're dealing with. I mean, I'm picturing the guy, as you say, whether it's a financial or is he doesn't have anybody to talk to because, you know, women, we're not very good at that. I think it's getting better, but I'm looking at it from my perspective. I have a really good group of friends. We do talk about pretty much everything, and it's great. But so the mental health aspect is quite an important jigsaw puzzle in your work.
Absolutely vital. I think up to very recently, or relatively recently, people have been averse to considering that there's any mental health aspect. And you know, studies show that people who have gone through infertility, used IVF, are at greater risk of postnatal depression, quite significantly so. So I always feel I'm front-loading people in advance to prevent, to obviate that. And the mental health aspect does have a significant impact on fertility over time. A lot of people were afraid originally, well, I don't want to be dubbed as having issues are being less than normal, and you know, the feeling of we're perfectly fine, we're absolutely healthy, I'm grand, we're managing this, we're wildly in love, everything's absolutely okay, being very brittle. And often people are here with me and it's like, I didn't realize I was, you know, feeling so crap, I didn't realize it was so difficult, I didn't realize I felt so alone, and I didn't realize that I could get help to calm myself down, to clear my head, to get a focus, restore hope, and just be more me than I've been for such a long time. And that's what I do. I don't like to, you know, paint a really dark picture about kind of, you know, mental health. But I do think that the discourse now is really helpful, that people are realizing that, you know, by going out for a lovely walk or having something delicious to eat or having a nice chat, listening to music, that's a mental health boost and protection, and that we need to do these things. And I think there's a greater integration. And I must say, I respect the younger generations so much for opening up this area.
What I like about what you offer versus the, let's call it the clinical, like you said at the beginning of this, every client comes to you, it's a completely different story. It's a completely different situation. There's no one like the other because we're all completely different. And I'm just picturing it, correct me if I'm wrong, but the couple that goes through you, I mean, you empowering them to make a decision, to make a change in their lives. I'm assuming there is, it's not 100% success rate with you either, because, you know, there can't be, there has to be. But at least they're in a situation where they've actually taken control of what they can and they cannot do, and they don't feel.
Absolutely.
As opposed to say, as you say, like earlier on, you said that there is the man sitting at home, he's done his bit, there's nothing else he can do. That's it. It's really hard to comprehend where you
can. And certainly, as you're saying there, Andrea, having an internal locus of control where you feel, okay, I'm doing this, 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 and this, I can drop that, that's okay. And the first thing people say to me is to be heard and understood, that I actually get what they're going through fully and completely. That is a big relief. The other thing is that many, many studies show that doing this work, a mind-body program, doubles the rate of success of IVF. And that is profound. If I can have, you know, someone come to me before their first IVF, that they will actually succeed and not have to go through the awful grief of failure, the awful grief of, you know, miscarriage. That is huge. And again, it saves money. Like, the money aspect, people are afraid to talk about, but it is so significant. It's very hard to assemble a spare, you know, 6 or 8 thousand. Even the prices in the clinics, they say $4,500, but that's before you get your medications that you have to take that cost $1,500. That's before you do so many. It's like a Nando's menu when you go in, that you're always adding and adding, and the side dish is a little bit too small, so you need another one, then you need a repeat. So, you know, I feel that the mind body aspect is, I work off proven programs, and that's what I've crafted for people. So the mind-body connection, the mindset, is hugely important going into IVF, and it does make it just makes a world of difference. And it's so profound, and such joy, such relief, such ease. And this is so simple. You know, it's not a Freudian going back over time. It's not a counseling thing where you're repeating and just mirroring and just talking around in circles. This is dynamic. It's alive. It's free. It's fun. It's, you know, it's really interesting. And clients find that they absolutely love it. You know, I think, gosh, I didn't know that this would make me feel so alive again.
Wonderful. You make me feel like I should think about having another baby now in my 50s. Okay, so tell me about Leonard Cohen, Hallelujah.
Oh, well, it's a bit of an old classic, isn't it? Leonard Cohen is, you know, my daughter is named Suzanne. Just the most amazing musician. I think he should have got the Nobel Prize. An incredible, wonderful musician and songwriter, and a lovely person. And the musicality of his work and the soundtrack of my youth are just absolutely amazing. I mean, the number of nights of magic playing, and it was just incredible. So Hallelujah certainly, I think, reunited a younger generation. It introduced them to stunning musicians who needed no autocue, and the heartfelt connection, the visceral connection that music brings is just profound. And the human voice, the number of iterations of this song, anybody can sing it and bring their own magic to it.
Now I've heard there was a secret chord that David played, and it pleased the Lord, but you don't really care for music, do you? It goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall, the major lift, the baffled king composing Hallelujah.
Okay, as we draw to a close, I want to ask you something. You're obviously very passionate about it. You said it several times, you love what you're doing. It doesn't feel like work. And it comes through just a simple conversation we're having. Obviously, I was joking about having another baby, but I can see the passion. And I can see how the couple walking out of your session would refer you, because I'm assuming a lot of your business is word of mouth. So I can see all of that. But because you're so involved, as you're interested in connection, what's it like? Because there's good news and the bad news all the time. And I know you've studied, you've done it for years, but what is it like? You know, you got text this morning to say somebody just had a baby, wonderful. What happens when it doesn't? How do you deal? How do you look after yourself for the bad news?
I look after myself so well, because do you know what? Nobody knows me as well as I know myself. Sure. And I've got my own handbook. So I'm happy. It's the only handbook I've ever read, the only set of instructions. So yes, I live a very quaintly ordered life. I live in a little country town. I go for a walk every single day with my beloved rescue dog who rescued me. And I eat lovely food that is very simple, very fresh. I have a penchant for old-fashioned fresh food. I don't normally eat sweet things. I love music. I like time by myself. Believe it or not, I'm an introvert on the Myers-Briggs scale. And I do enjoy all kinds of music. Again, as I say, from opera, I love Lyric FM. I love Gold. I love to listen to anything that stirs my blood. It can make me happy or make me sad. So when there is sad news, I do take it to my heart, and I do take the time to be with that person, either in literally talking to them and also reflecting on a little life that has not been, has not continued, a baby that hasn't been born, a loss. I do. And that is the permission I have. Back in my nursing days, it was like, no, you must never enter into this. No, as a human being, I do. as a carer, I do, as a mental health professional, I do. So I mind myself, I keep myself in very good condition. I am not madly into exercise. I'm basically a lazy bitch, but I love a good walk. I love a little bit of yoga. I love to dance around very badly. I love to read. I absolutely adore reading. That I fill my soul, I feed my soul, I look after my body, I keep my mind in good places. I know myself far more than I ever did in my youth.
Well, that's good. It's good to hear. And so then the last thing about this is just a personal curiosity, because the world we're living in at the moment with the coronavirus has just changed for all of us. And we're having this conversation over Zoom, and I normally would have a conversation face to face, but it feels like, I suppose I've done a few at this stage, it feels fine. It feels like we're connecting. Have you found that with your clients at the moment, you're doing the same, you're doing over internet, whatever application you're using, is it easier or is it harder for you or for them?
I've always been using online platforms for people who are based in the UK or France or Dubai or the States. It's just handier. Okay. Or even people up in Donegal, Kerry, who would have to come and stay in our local hotel, or, you know, people would have to fly. So I am very, very comfortable with this. In fact, originally I refused to join in until a client of mine broke her leg skiing and she wanted to talk to me. And I was saying, no, this will never work. And I had to go back to my association and eat humble pie, because I had to go back and say, do you know what? This is absolutely brilliant. I say now that I have people who are in their pajamas at home. They're on the sofa, they're in bed, and they are completely relaxed. They're very secure in their own environment. They don't have to come in here and get used to my surroundings. We can just get straight down to things. So I find that online is fantastic, and particularly generation of people that are very, very used to doing online meetings. You know, my clients range in age from about 27 to 45. So they are used to these platforms from work. And I find it very efficient, very simple. And I think you can connect really, really well.
Okay. Great. No, it definitely works. It works for me anyway. And this has been a wonderful conversation. We can go on forever, but I won't keep you, because I should let people know that it's your birthday. So happy birthday again. And I'm so delighted you're taking an hour off your birthday just to talk to me. That's fantastic. I always ask everybody for what I call them words of wisdom. And I know you gave a quote to one of the interviews you did, which was the Abraham Lincoln quote, but about sharpening the axe for 7 days, if you have 9 days to cut a tree. What's another quote that gets you going in the morning?
Well, a quote, I don't like quotes per se. I think they can be very trite, and they can paper over a lot of people's cracks, so to speak, in their lives. But the one that, you know, reverberates from childhood, and I suppose having just lived a completely medical life with you know, everybody who's involved, all our dinner table conversations, really and truly the one, and you actually quoted it, I was very amused earlier, Andrea, mens sana in corpore sano. It is the sense of that what you do when you wake up, when you pull your curtains, opening your window, ventilate the place, let air in, greet the morning, get ready for whatever happens, you know, air your bed, then make it, you know, the simple things that you can control that you do every day. And for now, you know, in coronavirus, people are anxious and, you know, times are uncertain and people forgetting, well, actually, you know, we're not quite totally in Anne Frank territory. You've got fabulous food. You've got your beautiful house. You've got your Netflix. You've got books. You can declutter and tidy, do everything you've ever wanted to do, 1,000 things online. So it's about appreciating the now. And, you know, the joy in the really simple stuff, like having running water, I always still appreciate. So those are the things that really keep me going very happily.
Wonderful. Okay, so the last song then is going to be Amy Winehouse. You say Back to Black, is that the whole album or the song in particular?
I love that song. I am inclined to play things on loop. I think her voice was unbelievable. Her talent was unparalleled and so bittersweet that she just was unable to continue and, you know, her life. So I absolutely love the plaintiveness of this song. You know, lost love, uncertain love is such an important part of our lives, to be loved, to love, to be connected.
Well, Alina Turvety, thanks a million for your time. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Andre. It's been a delight.